This is the first day of this four-day 2016 December Sesshin. I'm going to read from a book from Chan Master Sheng Yan. It's entitled Faith and Mind, and it's a collection of talks he gave in a series of different sesshins, all on the using as his text verses on the faith mind, or faith and mind. It's the same chant that we just did this morning. In our version, we begin, "The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose." His version is a little different, and since they're his talks, we'll go with his wording. I think sometimes in order to make a text chant well, it's maybe not quite so faithful to the original Chinese as when you're just writing it out in prose, translating it in prose. In either case, the sense is captured. So a little bit about Sheng Yan. I'm not going to go through his whole autobiography, which is in one of the books that I've been looking at. But he died a few years back. He had a center in New York and Queens, and then a retreat center, I think somewhere, maybe in the Catskills, somewhere. In New York, they would call it upstate, but of course we know better than here in Rochester. And he taught, all over the world, and as well as having what was apparently just an astounding center, monastery, temple, whatever you might call it, in Taiwan. When that was dedicated, Roshi was invited and went there, and he reported that it really made Chapin Mill look pretty ordinary, which was a little comforting to us who maybe thought we were a little over the top. There's a lot more top to go, evidently. So Sheng Yan is, he also was a friend of Roshi Kaplow's. Roshi Kaplow visited him when he was traveling, when he made his trip to China. And actually those little pagoda-like rotating lights that we set outside the Buddha Hall when we have temple night, if you've ever noticed those were a gift from Sheng Yan on one of those trips. Sheng Yan was born, obviously, in China and became a monk at a really early age. The war with Japan happened, and I think that sort of turned everybody's world upside down. He ended up eventually doing a solitary retreat, I think about 6 years in China, and then went to Japan partly for academic studies. He was something of a scholar of Buddhism as well as being a practitioner. But while he was in Japan, he studied with a Dharma successor of Harada Roshi, the same Harada Roshi that Roshi Kaplow studied with. So we're related in a way. In his introduction here, he says a little bit about the phrase faith and mind. He says it contains two meanings of believing in and realizing the mind. Mind is especially emphasized in Chan. Of course, by Chan we mean Zen. Zen is just the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese Chan, which I believe is the Chinese pronunciation of the Indian Dhyana. Just means meditation. It says, true faith in mind is the belief grounded in realization that we have this fundamental, unmoving, unchanging mind. This mind is precisely Buddha mind, the Buddha mind of every being, every sentient being. But the mind experienced by ordinary beings in the midst of vexations is deluded mind, not true mind. For those who seek to rid themselves of vexation, those who seek to rid themselves of vexations imagine that there is a true mind to attain. However, from the perspective of Buddha mind, there is only one mind, neither true nor false. There is no need to discriminate, for everything, everywhere, is mind everlasting. When we fully realize Buddha mind, the believing mind and the mind which is believed in merge into one. Since they are the same, the need for mere belief in this mind disappears. The paradox is that one must be enlightened to have true faith in this mind. It's faith in the sense of knowing, not just believing. The author is speaking from a deeply enlightened perspective to the practitioner who seeks to discover a true mind. Sung San, that's the purported author of these verses, he was the third patriarch in China. Sung San shows us how to transform our ordinary discriminating mind into the Buddha mind which does not discriminate. How to get from existence to emptiness, from defilement to purity. He tells us how we should practice and what kind of mental attitude to avoid during practice. We should not give in to our likes and dislikes, neither trying to negate our vexations nor seeking enlightenment. The practice should be pursued for its own sake. While there should be no other purpose, in the end, the mind of equanimity is realized. There is no discrimination, no need for language, or indeed of practice. Of course, a pretty advanced state. This is, as you know from chanting it, this is a pretty long text, and there's no way we have time in a 4-day sesshin to go through all of it. So I'll be picking and choosing. But we'll begin at the beginning, and his translation goes like this. The supreme way is not difficult if only you do not pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. That is, don't love, don't hate, and you will clearly understand. Be off by a hair, and you are as far from it as heaven from earth. So that's the chunk of text. And then Cheng Yen says, the sole purpose of a Chan retreat is to meditate. You should keep your attention entirely on practice without trying to attain any results. Since many of you have traveled far or have worked hard to set aside the time, you have a great deal invested in this retreat. It is natural that you want to gain something, but once you enter the retreat, you must put aside any specific hopes. It's kind of a delicate point. We practice because we have an aspiration, but the less we get into exactly what we want and how we want things to go, the more likely we are to realize that aspiration. It's not a help, obviously, as we'll be hearing, to hold in the mind what it is we want to achieve. As if we could know what we want to achieve. Anything you think of is a thought. It's not what we're after. He says, practicing with a goal in mind is like trying to catch a feather with a fan. The more you go after it, the more it eludes you. But if you sneak up on it slowly, you can grab it. So this is Cheng Yen has a whole book called Catching a Feather on a Fan. This is an analogy that he's very fond of, and I am too. And I want to read a somewhat longer description. This is from a book entitled Catching a Feather on a Fan. About this analogy. He says, meditation is like using a fan, the old-fashioned handheld type. You have the task of catching a feather on the fan. Every time you move the fan, the feather is likely to be blown away. If anyone can relate to this, it is a delicate business. You have to hold the fan quite still, just under the space through which the feather is sinking of its own motion. The feather then comes to rest on the top of the fan. You can imagine how difficult or easy this may be. Any use of force and the feather is lost. Yet once you grasp the principle, it is something very easy to do. Stilling the mind is like catching a feather with a fan. It needs patience and persistence. When practicing, do not be afraid of a distracting thought. If your body has a problem, do not be concerned with it. If your mind is worrying, put the worry down. Keep the mind on the method, waiting for the feather to sink onto the fan. Suppose you are in a very good situation. No distractions, no wandering thoughts. Whatever you do, never congratulate yourself. Away goes the feather at once. So don't be happy. Do not think how successful you are. Just observe the situation without movement, towards or away. If the mind moves, wandering thoughts begin. Think of all the years of practice I spent trying to still the mind by force. Sometimes we have to go through that, I think. When we're desperate to make progress, we try every way we can think of, but it's good to observe what happens. When we let greed drive our practice, the results are generally not so great. He says, the aim of practice is to develop patience and forbearance, to train your mind to become calm and stable. Any attachment or seeking will prevent your mind from settling down. Again, it's that difference between aspiration and looking for some specific result. Today someone told me that the more he worked on his koan, the more tense he felt. Actually, the word that Ching Yen used here is wado or wato. I'm not sure how it's pronounced in Chinese. I think in Japanese it's wado, which means the nub of the koan, the question at the core of the koan. The more he worked on it, the more tense he felt. It was as though his mind had become knotted up. His problem is that he wants to see quick results. Pursuing the wado intensively with a desire to get enlightened is like tying yourself up and then poking yourself with a knife. The more you drive yourself, the more tense you will feel. The same principle applies to the body. If you react to pain by tensing the body, the pain will only get worse. If any part of your body feels painful, you should try to relax it. Any involuntary movement of the body while sitting in meditation is also due to tension. Thus, it is important to constantly maintain a state of relaxation. The Chinese emphasize relaxation much more than the Japanese do. Speaking for myself, I find that really helpful. We're really relaxing into the practice. It isn't a question of being slack or allowing the mind to wander, but it's more a question of not getting caught up in tension. And the tension is wanting to grasp or wanting to push away. It's what we want and what we dislike that cause all of our problems. Going on, he says, related to this are the problems that may develop from fixing your attention on a particular part of the body. For instance, some people may try to make their breath flow smoothly, but in trying to control the breath, it becomes abnormal. Now, there are breath practices where you are trying to breathe in a certain pattern, but for someone practicing Zen, at least our brand of Zen, instructions are to let the breath take its own course, not to try to control it or have the exhalations be longer in some way than the inhalations or vice versa, but just to be aware, just to watch what it does, just to become intimate with the breath. Going on, he says, don't pay attention to any phenomenon that occurs to the body. If you're concerned with it, problems will arise. It is the same with the mind. You will be unable to practice unless you disregard everything that happens to you mentally. If you feel distressed or pained in any way, just ignore it. Let it go and return wholeheartedly to the method. Place your mind directly on the method itself. Concern yourself with nothing else. It's very difficult to get into the habit of letting negative mental states be and ignoring them. We were trained to fix things, and certainly nothing cries out to us to be fixed more than mental anguish or pain or disturbance. The more you work with this practice, the more you see how much of our attention is caught up in trying to get what we like and trying to avoid what's painful. Sometimes even just a slight little twinge of a glimmer of the possibility of pain can be enough to throw us off. And the antidote is to take it all in, to be willing to be with negative feelings, to be willing to be with pain, to be able to relax into it, not to try to be the autocrat or dictator of our experience. Just as we let the breath be, we let the body be, let the mind be. The Supreme Way, in the first line of the poem, refers to the state of Buddhahood. The wisdom of the Buddha is not difficult to perceive. It can be attained in the instant between two thoughts. The reason for this is that it has never been separate from us. It is always present. In fact, we all desire to realize this supreme way. If so, why are we unable to attain it? The second line explains what prevents us. It is because we are always trying to escape our vexations. Great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Precisely because we want to acquire the Buddha's insight and merits, we are unable to perceive Buddha nature. Another reason why we cannot see our Buddha nature is that we are burdened with ideas. We make distinctions between samsara and nirvana, sentient beings, ordinary beings, and the Buddha, vexations and enlightenment. These ideas obstruct our perception of Buddha nature. To paraphrase lines 3 and 4, as soon as you discard your likes and dislikes, the way will immediately appear before you. Here, Sung San has something in common with Dao Xin, the fourth patriarch, and Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch. The latter two frequently said that when you stop discriminating between good and evil, you will immediately perceive your original face. In Chan, original face refers to one's innate Buddha nature. In other words, you will understand the supreme way. When sitting, some of you are distracted with pain or are trying to fight off drowsiness. At night, maybe you are angry at someone who is keeping you awake with his snoring. Of course, in this session, everyone has their own room, so you don't get to have that practice. lest your own snoring wakes you up. But he says, instead of letting it annoy you, just observe the snoring. Soon the snores may become hypnotic and repetitive, actually pleasant sounding. If you start counting the snores, before you know it, you will be asleep. It's a very interesting principle. There's so many things that we find maddening that someone else would have no trouble with at all. And it's helpful to reflect on that. Basically, the problem isn't outside us. The problem is our reactions. It's our likes and dislikes, once again. I know this. I think the reason why Sheng Yen brings this particular example up is that in another book, he mentioned at some point when he was on a retreat with a couple of, he was actually rooming with a couple of Chan masters. I think he himself was just a monk at the time, and they both snored, and he had to find a way, and he did. He was able to just get into it. Same is true of physical pain. So much of our difficulty is our instinctive, it seems instinctive, our conditioned desire to have things be different than they are. Zen is about things as they are, to come into harmony with things as they are. And things as they are aren't always great, at least from our point of view. Because on the other hand, becoming attached to a certain pleasurable experience in meditation can also be an obstruction. One student I had would rock her body during sitting meditation. She felt that she had no control over the shaking. It just happened spontaneously. Actually, this was not caused by any physical tension, but by a subconscious motive. The rocking was comfortable to her. You cannot practice effectively if you give in to such things. By examining them, you will be able to control the mind. It really is important in sitting to sit still. So much of sitting is stillness in the body, and that can translate into stillness in the mind. There is a tendency, I think especially for people working on a koan, to try to push with the body. And I know from my own practice, there have been times when I tried rocking as a way to get more deeply into it. And you see people do it sometimes in chanting, get into some sort of rhythmic body motion. But really that's not what we want to do. We want to be completely still. It's much more promising. It says, holding on to various likes and dislikes keeps you apart from the way. Discarding them will bring you into accord with the way. But if there is the slightest misconception about this, the distance between you and the way will be as great as that between heaven and earth. Don't misinterpret this and think that since you are not supposed to attach to likes and dislikes, you should therefore not bother to cultivate the way. With this attitude, it is useless to come on a Chan retreat. When you first set out to practice, you will definitely have a goal in mind. You may be frustrated with your present condition and aim either to change yourself or to improve your circumstances. Certainly there is something you hope to achieve by practicing. You cannot just practice aimlessly. So practice itself implies some intention or desire. But then he goes on, to fulfill your original intentions, you must constantly keep your mind on the method of practice. But as you focus on the method, you should not be thinking of what you want to accomplish, what level you want to reach, or what problems you want to get rid of. Instead, your mind should be exclusively applied to the method itself, free from all other motives. It's such a temptation to try to shape the mind, to try to add something in. look over our shoulder and try to come into conformity with the picture that we have of what good practice would be like. Of course, it's just a picture. It's probably got all the subtlety of a child's crayon drawing on a refrigerator. Our ideas of what samadhi or enlightenment are. And for practice, they're useless. They're an impediment. They're worse than useless. We need to have faith that doing this practice, as simple and on the surface looks boring, just to be with the breath, just to be asking this one question. We have to have faith that that will change us. We have to develop this taste for awareness, this this fascination with paying attention. There's so much that happens when we do this, but we don't get to direct it. We're just there for the ride. It's like there's the analogy of walking through the mist. This applies to good effects and bad effects. You walk through the mist, you're going to get wet. If you leave your thoughts and leave your preferences and bring your mind to the practice, or as Shengyan says, to the method, that will work its magic. Not on your schedule, not to conform to your timetable. Really takes renunciation. We really need to be willing to let the practice work. We have to have faith. Faith in the process, as Roshi says. In a way, it's a relief. We're not in charge of running the show. I think we all suspect we're pretty bad at it. But we're in charge of just our own devotion, just coming back again and again and again and again. In the process, frustration comes up because we do have likes and dislikes. We are ordinary sentient beings. We have to be okay with that. You can get into a weird hall of mirrors where you think, okay, I shouldn't have preferences, but I do, and so that means I'm a bad student. Well, now you have preferences about whether or not you have preferences. It's just, at some point, you just have to laugh and let them go. And that's where the method is so helpful, the practice is so helpful. It's so basic and so simple. We just have to pick it up. The fact that we dropped it 2 seconds ago is no longer relevant. We're working only with this moment. We say this again and again and again, and it's because we need to. We need to come back again and again to our need to just be with things as they are. All joy, all spontaneity, all equanimity come from our ability to just be here now. It says, there is a saying that is useful for practitioners. Put down the myriad thoughts. Take up the practice. The myriad thoughts are scattered, random, extraneous concerns. The practice is your method of cultivation. When your mind wanders to extraneous concerns, put them down as soon as they appear. Of course, this can be tricky, because sometimes if we the concerns grab hold of us, we're not even aware that our mind has wandered. Roshi says it's a two-step process, notice and return. It's definitely the case that sometimes we get sidetracked and we don't know it. So what does that mean? After maybe 5 minutes of rumination, suddenly it occurs to us, oh, right, the breath. It doesn't matter. We just need to come back at that moment when we realize that what's important is our willingness, once we recognize, to turn back immediately, not to dawdle, not to waste time, not to play with whatever fear or desire has captured our attention. Recognize, drop it, and return. When your mind wanders to extraneous concerns, put them down as soon as they appear. But should you treat the method in the same way as a wandering thought, putting it down as soon as it appears? No. From moment to moment, put down extraneous thoughts and return your mind to the method of practice. Perhaps you try to put down extraneous concerns, but find that you just can't. Every time you put one down, it comes back again. This upsets you. You keep telling yourself, put it down, put it down. Actually, it doesn't matter that you can't put it down. If you eventually get to the point where you say to yourself, it doesn't matter if I can't put it down, then you will be putting it down. You should not fear failure, neither should you embrace it. You may conclude that the retreat is not going well for you, your body is uncomfortable, your mind is in tumult. You're unable to control yourself. You haven't made the proper preparations, so you think, why not forget this one and leave tomorrow? Hope nobody is thinking along those lines. Maybe I'll try again the next time, but don't succumb to this defeatist attitude. A Chinese proverb says, 100 birds in a tree are not worth one bird in the palm. It's kind of familiar. We go with two in a bush, but 100 birds in a tree are not worth one bird in the palm. If you let go of that one bird to go after the 100, you will end up with nothing. Even though you feel unprepared and doomed to failure, being here still presents a wonderful opportunity to practice. It really helps to realize there isn't any bad practice. Really. We're just getting what we get. There's a saying somewhere that Buddhism is being happy to see your obstructions arise, your vexations, to use Sheng Yen's language. That's really how we grow, is by working with what's difficult. It's as if we've taken on this job of cleaning out an enormous messy room. And instead of getting to work and cleaning it out, we start wishing that the room was clean. We're not here to clean out a clean room. The next four lines in the verse in Sheng Yen's translation are, if you want the way to appear, be neither for nor against. For and against opposing each other, this is the mind's disease. He says, if you want the Buddha way to manifest before your eyes, it is a mistake to harbor any preferences or aversions. This includes anything you hope to acquire, keep, discard, or avoid. When sitting seems to be going particularly well, the idea may pop into your mind that you are about to be enlightened. You begin to wait for this enlightenment experience. With this expectation, the mind has already abandoned its single-mindedness and has become confused and scattered. This is a very common occurrence as people move along in their practice. We get into new territory And it's exciting, and it's also agitating. It's just a condition. It's promising. It's wonderful. It can change us. It can change the way we relate to people. But we can't get caught up in it. Our job is always to be with the method, to be with the practice. And so whether it's good results or bad results, paying attention to either one is self-defeating. On the other hand, it's very hard not to get caught up when things really go well. It's just natural. And sometimes we have to go through the experience of getting deep and then going off track and losing it and maybe getting back there again and again, going off track, until finally it sinks in. Okay, this is just changing scenery. I'm just going to continue working. Just going to stay here. Let the results take care of themselves. It says, on a prior retreat, one student was progressing so well that there were notable changes in his mental state. At that point, he became frightened. He thought, I'm happy with the way I am now. I really don't want any drastic changes. What if my friends don't recognize me? He did not sit as well for the rest of the retreat. Don't worry, your friends will always recognize you. This contradictory mentality often afflicts the practitioner. He wants to enter the door of enlightenment, but at the same time, he is really afraid of entering. You come to a retreat with a desire to transform yourself. Indeed, practice can make you more mature, calm, and stable. It will certainly not change you into something less human or ghost-like. Since ancient times, all of the numerous practitioners who have gotten deeply enlightened remained human, the only difference being that afterward they were more stable and filled with wisdom. There is no reason to fear changing that way. But such a contradictory state of mind is common among ordinary people. When I left home as a young boy, I was very excited about becoming a monk. But on the other hand, I had never been to a monastery and had some apprehension. I just did not know what would happen there. Many people who believe in heaven have similar fears about what it will be like after death. This is why everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. These contradictions point to inherent weaknesses in our personality of which we are usually unaware. It is only in the context of practice that these weaknesses are exposed. Once we discover and understand our weaknesses, we can prevent them from further obstructing our practice. In other words, we have to see it first. It's the sense in which the bad news is good news. Get a chance to clean the stables. How do we clean the stables? It's by dropping our concerns. We can't push them away. It's not effective to think our way through them, to argue with ourselves. It's just that dispassionate dropping of those concerns. Remember that phrase in Roshi's reading of the Buddha's Enlightenment? Described his mind as smooth as a rock, with no place for concerns to take hold. This is the result of years of practice. It says, although for and against are opposites, they are also very much related. If there is something that you like, there must be something else that you dislike. If you cannot get what you like, you may change your mind and dislike it. To be caught in this conflict between like and dislike is a serious disease of the mind. It is a barrier to practice. Practice is a process by which we recognize and treat the disease of our minds. or we could say it's a process by which we recognize the disease and somehow it is treated. When the disease is completely disappears, the ultimate way is revealed. Skipping ahead a little bit, you should not remain passively in peacefulness. Don't be afraid of difficulties. If your mind cannot settle down, you should not feel any resentment. Cultivate non-aversion to the unpleasant and non-attachment to the pleasant. Taking a pleasurable state for enlightenment will get you into trouble. Enlightenment is not something we have to guard fiercely, not letting it go. If a pleasant state arises, don't get stuck on it. Just continue to practice. On a past retreat, one person sat through 4 30-minute periods without stirring. Seeing that his condition was too good, I struck him with the incense board. That's their word for a kiyosaku, the encouragement stick. Whereupon he grabbed the board and hit me. Pretty exciting sesshin, saying, "I was in such a blissful state, and now I have lost samadhi." Aside from the fact that practitioners should not have any attachments, it is not the purpose of chan to remain in samadhi. It is not necessarily good for the mind to settle down too quickly. Chan is a lively practice. It is not difficult to maintain a calm mind in a stationary situation. But in chan, one should be able to retain mental calmness even in a mobile state. The message is always, don't rest. Don't rest on your laurels. Don't coast. Well, he moves on to some more lines here, but our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.